It's Guy Raz here, the host of Weekends and All Things Considered. Thanks for downloading this podcast. Normally, we include the weekend's best stories from Weekends on All Things Considered. That podcast is always uploaded each Sunday night at npr.org/weekendATC, so please check it out. For now, here's my full interview with Marc Maron. He's a comedian, of course, whose podcast WTF is one of the most popular out there. It's available at WTFpod.com or at iTunes. Okay, now for people who haven't heard the podcast, describe what it is. What do you do?
I basically talk in my garage alone for about 10 minutes about whatever's on my mind. Usually it's, I wouldn't say neurotic, but I open up a valve and talk about myself and how I fit into the world. And a lot of people relate to that because a lot of people don't open that valve. And then I'll have a peer or a comedian or a writer or somebody I kind of know come to my garage and sit down and talk to me, usually for around an hour, if not longer, until we arrive at some authentic tone of conversation about whatever it is. As long as it's real conversation, I'm in for it. I'm into it.
Okay, so you've got about 200,000 people downloading your podcast every week. Huge names in comedy coming onto your program. But you know, it's just you and some mics in your garage, and is that basically? Am I basically describing it correctly?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It's just me and a couple of mics and a weird old mixer that I plug into my computer, and someone has taught me how to do exactly that. That's about as expansive as my technology is.
you've had guests like Robin Williams, Judd Apatow, Ray Romano, Louis C.K. How do you get such huge names into your garage on your podcast?
Well, actually, all those that you mentioned, I will also travel a bit. I will take my little microphones and my little tape recorder and go elsewhere if need be. But I have had Ben Stiller was in my garage. Ed Helms was just in my garage. Aziz Ansari. I mean, a lot of them come to the garage, but I'm not. Some I'll do in a car. I'm willing to travel. But the way I get them to come is, like, for instance, Judd Apatow was a fan of the show. And he loved listening to comics, and he liked the tone of the show, and he reached out to me. It was sort of funny. I got an email from Patton Oswalt saying, would you mind if I gave Judd Apatow your email? Hmm. So I wrote back to Patton. I said, you can't just be handing out my email to everybody. I appreciate that you asked me that, but no, absolutely not. And then I said, of course you can. But with Louis, that was another situation. Louis and I have a long history. Look, I'm a comedian. I've been doing comedy for 25 years. I've lived in three or four different cities in my life. There's very few people in my business, in my community, that I don't know directly or I don't know through somebody else. I am a defined enough person that I have somewhat of a reputation, whether if it's infamous or not, that's up to the individual. But I just reach out.
But here's what I want to know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be some other reason they come to your garage. Is there something else going on in the garage? Do you have a side business, or is there something going on in there?
Well, I think maybe they're expecting me to give them a book. I have a lot of books in the garage, some I've had since college. Sometimes there's a T-shirt or two laying around with a WTF. I don't know that that's why they're coming. I think there might just be curiosity. I think there's actually the question of, is it really a garage? I've had people come in and say things like, I expected it to be different. So, people definitely picture the garage. It happens to be a little cleaner than it was before, which I find it's good, but it's not so good.
And you don't keep your car in there?
No, it's an old garage. I'm not sure that it could hold the car. And for some reason, maybe at another time, that my driveway is very narrow, and I don't keep my car in there. I've actually put a floor down, and because the concrete beneath it was crumbling, and I had a guy come over, and he said, I said, what would it take to fix this? He said, well, we got to pour new cement. I'm like, how about fix it just kind of? He goes, I guess we could build a floor over it and just try to level it, to make it level. I'm like, let's do that then. So that's what's going on in the garage.
Judd Apatow said that that he thinks, because I should mention, people really open up. I mean, you get these comics on, Ray Romano talking about being depressed after Everybody Loves Raymond, ended. And sort of Sam Kinison's best friend talking about watching him die. Why do you think all these people open up to you?
Because I think that I show up for the interview. I don't look at them as interviews, and these people are sort of people I know, and I actually have a lot of respect for them, and I understand that we're all comics and that makes us unique. So I'm not afraid to talk about myself a bit so we can both get on the same page. And I think that a lot of times, if you listen to somebody and you really listen, that you no longer really know that there are mics there, and people want to be heard. They want to share this stuff. I mean, I think if there's anything about the podcast that resonates with people that may not even be fans of comedy or know who's talking, is that so much of what we experience in a very real emotional way, we don't let out, because all of our energy goes into getting by. And these are inner dialogues and feelings that, you know, they just get stuffed, and comics want to talk about it, and they deal with these struggles, and they're very sensitive, and they, you know, people want to talk about it.
Describe where you were in your life when you decided to do the podcast.
I was in trouble. I was in the middle of a divorce. I was, you know, close to broke. I'd just been fired for a third time from Air America, who was once again having money problems. I'd gone back there knowing that they had fired me twice because I needed money to get out of this divorce, and I was sort of stuck. My manager at the time said that I was unbookable and nobody wanted to represent me, and I was a respected guy, but I didn't know what I was going to do, and I didn't have any money, and I was in New York, and I had to go back to LA. That's where I was. I was relatively desperate and completely, you know, had no idea how to continue with my life and career.
So you figured, let me try this.
Well, we were there, you know, the guy I was working with on my show at Air America, we were there, they fired us, and they're, you know, obviously you work in radio, you know, protocol is to anybody who sits in front of a mic and talks, when you fire them, you make sure they're out of the building because they're going to get to that mic somehow. Well, that wasn't really the problem. What happened was they didn't take our security cards away from us, and we were doing an internet show, and they didn't even take our office away. They stopped the show, but you know, we were both under contract for another few weeks, so we said, look, you know, let's just come in late at night. We'll just, you know, hijack the studio when no one's here. And let's see what we come up with. And so I was bringing guests up the freight elevator and having people text me in the street and going down. We had a friend in the night tech, and we basically did the first handful of shows, you know, after hours at a radio station that we'd both been fired from, and that was the beginning of it.
You go to some pretty dark places with a lot of the people who come on your show. I should say that you don't always do that, of course, but you do. I mean, you go to some of these pretty dark corners with these really well-known comics, and I guess I'm wondering, it's like the perennial question, like why do so many comedians have such a messed up life?
I don't know, really, in looking at it honestly, in terms of the feedback I get from episodes, I don't know that they have that messed up a life. I think everybody has problems, and everybody has, you know, family issues, and everybody has dark places that they go to. What's interesting is that these people are comedians, and by virtue of that, they've really committed their life to something that is, for most practical people, ridiculous and difficult. And I think the one thing that they all share is some sort of strange determination to do this seemingly impossible thing, which is, you know, become a good comic and make a living at it by, you know, entertaining people and sort of making light or shining light on those dark places. So I can't really answer the question in a way that would say they're different than other people. Mm-hmm. I think what makes them different is that they make it okay for other people to have dark places, that their job is to be funny, to take people out of that darkness, and that's what makes them different. I'm not sure why that is.
I mean, you've had your own fair share of ups and downs, and you've written about it, and I want to ask you about that in a moment. But do you think that you have to have some of that to be a good comic?
I think that the better comics have a certain courage and depth around their pain, whatever it may be, you know, whether it's anger or pain or some need to be recognized or acknowledged for being funny. I would say yes, on some level. I would say that it brings depth to the performance. There are plenty of comics that don't have difficult or horrendous pasts. But there's something there if they're good.
You started out as a doorman at the Comedy Store, which is a pretty legendary place in L.A. You called it, and I'm quoting you, the devil's way of giving back to the world. Why?
Well, that place is, it's a pretty dark place. It seems almost haunted. If you go to the Comedy Store, even now, there's a feeling that you're on some sort of ride, some sort of haunted clown castle. At that time that I wrote about that, yeah, I was very consumed with the myth of the Comedy Store. With, you know, it used to be this old nightclub back in the 30s and 40s called Ciro's. There were, you know, mob. There was all kinds of weird myths around it. But also, I was, you know, under the guiding and dangerous, crushing wing of Sam Kennison. So the type of comedy that I gravitated to was definitely something dark. And I always thought that in relation to the devil or whatever we may think of the devil, that what emanated out of that place was a lot of darkness and a lot of pain that was somehow going through the mill of all of these separate consciousness, I don't know how to pluralize conscience, what am I trying to say? That there was an id to the place that was, you know, fundamentally dark, and everybody there was channeling it and turning it into comedy. It was a metaphor I was working with, but it still holds a little bit. I guarantee you, anybody you talk to about that place will be like, oh yeah, the darkness is there.
I mean, you say darkness, and of course you talk about Sam Kinison, and some of that darkness was, some of that was in part because of your relationship and friendship with him, right?
Definitely, definitely. There was. It's an interesting thing about that time in terms of darkness, in terms of, you know, the intensity of pushing the envelope comedically and really getting dark and the challenge of making that darkness funny. And I don't think, you know, there's a difference between being shocking and really taking darkness and putting it on the anvil and making it entertainment and making it rise to the level of comedy. And I thought that was completely engaging. Obviously there were drugs involved, but, you know, sometimes, you know, the tools of the trade are the tools of the trade.
You've written about Sam Kinison, you've written about drugs and about that whole world. And I mean, how much did that kind of like overtake you? Were you, I mean, for a while, did you kind of think that that was it?
That was it, what, the end of my life? Or that just, was what,
yeah,
I was going to do?
Yeah, everything.
Well, both. You know. Look, it's taken me a long time to get, you know, to get a lot of sober years under my belt to reflect on this stuff. But, you know, I grew up a guy that, you know, my heroes were always, you know, outlaws and rebels. My heroes were always drug fiends, you know, whether it be, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, Lenny Bruce, Keith Richards. I mean, that was where I came from. That was what, you know, seemed appealing to me. And I definitely was committed to it and thought that, you know, it entitled me to a certain access to a level of perception that that other people didn't have, and that's certainly true for a small window of the time that you do those things. It's tough territory to negotiate, and after a certain point, you no longer have choice in it, and then you have to get out or take the risks that come with committing to that.
And then you left L.A. after the drugs, I guess, became too much.
I left running from L.A. I was literally, you know, I had pushed myself way too far, and I left L.A., you know, feeling like I was being chased by things that didn't exist. And I went home and renewed my passport because I was pretty sure I was going to have to run through those things. I was going to have to run from those things that didn't exist that my mind was generating for quite a while.
Where'd you go?
I went back to Albuquerque, and everything worked out. I cleaned up and, you know, waited for all that to dissipate. You know, your brain comes back eventually.
At what point did you sort of hit your lowest point?
At that time? Well, you know, you get really sort of, when you're in a circle that's living that way, you don't realize that really no one else lives that way, and it becomes your reality. And what happened was the social fabric of the circle kind of broke down. You know, I did something to you know, piss Sam Kennison off, and then I was you know, ostracized.
What'd you do?
I let a Satanist sleep with his guitar. So that's how weird it got. That's all I'm saying is that, you know, these things happen. I explain it in the book, you know, if people want to look at, you know, go find Jerusalem Syndrome. I think it's still available.
Do you think Sam Kinison is somebody you would have on your show today if he was still alive?
Absolutely.
And you guys would talk about your falling out?
Absolutely.
I mean, you did that with Louis C.K. You guys had, you were really close. You had a falling out, and you spent, you know, most of the podcast talking about that.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it was different. And I also spoke about it with Sam Kennison's best friend, who they were inseparable at the time I knew them recently, Carl LeBeau, mm-hmm. which it was a very, you know, the humility involved in working things through, you know, in talking to somebody for an hour. You know, and Louis and I are old friends, and I have a lot of love for Louis, and we were very close at some point in our lives, and we have a lot of things that we share in common, and I think some of them are a sort of self-centeredness. So, you know, we had just become, you know, distant, and it always sort of hurt me because you know, there's very few people in my life, I think in anyone's life, that can really, you know, make them feel okay. That, you know, the one thing about comics is that, you know, I think a lot of people like comics because they make them feel better. And, you know, when you are a comic, that becomes hard to find. And Louis was always one of those guys that could put things into perspective for me. And even if we didn't talk much, you know, there was always this understanding that we could return to that. And somehow we had lost touch with that. And when I went to his apartment to do the show, he's very busy now, and he's, you know, he's a huge star, and it's well deserved. And I had to deal with a lot of my, you know, jealousy of that, and a lot of why, you know, to sort of take responsibility for my my part in dismantling that friendship. And we just had a real conversation about this stuff. It's very emotional.
When you bring guests on, do you write scripts or do you prepare for the interviews, or do you just sort of go with whatever direction it goes in?
I generally don't prepare anything for anything. I, you know, when I talk on the mic at the beginning, I pace around my house and I try to do about as many things as I can before I get out in the garage. And, you know, and then I just kind of focus on a through line in my head and I just go at it. And with the interviews, you know, maybe to a fault sometimes, but not usually. A lot of times I don't know much about who I'm interviewing in terms of, you know, what they've done or what they're working on or anything like that. I just make the assumption that we're going to have a conversation about something. So sometimes I'll write a few things down that I'm interested about in terms of who that person is, and I'll write a few things down about my thoughts about it. But I don't make a script, and I don't do research, and usually that works out.
What do you consider the kind of like the best moment with a guest, like a breakthrough?
Well, there's been different ones at different times. What I like is that, you know, we assume, not unlike anyone does in a community, you assume you know these people. I've known a lot of these people for 20 years, mm-hmm. and I swear to you, I've never had more than a 10-minute conversation with them. Like, even with Dave Attell, who I love and I consider a friend because we're in the same community. Look, when your life is built around, you know, sleeping till noon and doing, you know, nightclub spots until 2 a.m, you know, it's a fairly specific group of people.
I would say so, yeah.
But that's our life, and we have a lot of freedom. We have a lot of freedom to think about things. We have a lot of freedom to, you know, to spend that time however we're going to spend it. You know, and you can argue that a lot of it's wasted, but that's the life we signed up for. But there, it's a unique breed of person, so you feel a kindred spirit. But when it comes right down to it, I've known Dave Attell for 20 years. I don't think I've ever talked to him for more than 10 minutes. He's hard to sort of get to sit still. And when he sat and talked to me for an hour, you know, all of a sudden it's like I never knew you. And I always had this assumption, and now I just feel closer to you. So a lot of those things happen on the podcast where, you know, I literally find out things about people and I make myself emotionally available in the conversation and I listen and I'm surprised at finding things out. Like Bob Odenkirk is another great example where I had no idea, you know, how much, you know, rage he carried inside him and how personally he got about that. Robin Williams, you know, even Ira Glass. I mean, I didn't, you know, I interviewed Ira. I only knew him from This American Life, but I felt like I knew him. And then you talk to them and you're like, oh my God, it was great getting to know you. And I'm sorry you had to go through that, or thanks for sharing that, or wow, you know, we're both different people now that we've had that conversation.
You found out that Ira was a very violent guy, actually.
He almost killed me.
Yeah.
I mean, he chased me out of there with a mic stand, yelling, and I'm in the street. I didn't know whether to call the police. Very surprising.
He's a street fighter.
Yeah, absolutely.
People think about, you know, these sort of public radio kind of wimps, and we're not. I mean, we're...
That's why I assumed that there was something lurking under there with all of you. I had to run from my life from Ira Glass's studio. Run for my life.
I've lost my train of thought. I say this in a very complimentary way. I hope it doesn't come across in a bad way, but it sounds almost like you're kind of a therapist in a way for some of these people.
And for myself, I don't know. You know, I've been thinking a lot about that assessment of what I'm doing. And what I think, honestly, is that one of the things that has been lost in this culture in an earnest way, if we're going to bring that word back, is the ability for people to sit and talk for real. You know, for an hour. I mean, really, when was the last time you just sat and talked to someone for an hour? Mm. I mean, it's something that people can do. But, you know, everything is mediated. There's a lot of technology between us. We speak in sort of like, you know, sentences without any tone to them through email, through text, through... It gets to the point now where, you know, you'd rather text than even pick up the phone. So I just think that our culture is no longer familiar with the idea of just people talking about life. Sitting down and taking an hour and talking. Is that therapy, or is it just some sort of human pastime that has become lost? I don't know. But I think that what's happened to me personally from listening and talking to my peers is I feel like I'm living more in the present, that you know, I have more humility about myself and my problems in terms of finding that they're not unusual, that I'm not that unusual, yet the things that are unique about me, you know, are mine and I can own them. So if it's been therapy for anybody, it's probably for me. But I think a lot of people are excited to have these conversations, and I don't know that it's therapy as much as it is, you know, just something humans have lost sight of.
I mean, does the appeal of the podcast surprise you? I mean, 200,000 downloads a week is a lot of downloads.
And I think it's even more now. And honestly, I think, look, you know, in this month, I mean, in the first half of the month, we've had 1 million downloads already, and I don't really think about it that much. You know, in my mind, I'm still going out to my garage, and I'm still, you know, dealing with myself on the mic and with having a conversation with somebody. You know, I drove up to Santa Barbara yesterday to talk to Jonathan Winters for an hour, and I was driving home, and there's so many things that are being revealed to me about life that I just, because of how insulated I am in myself and the profession I've chosen, that I'm really coming at them late in life. And the one thing that I'm amazed about is that, look, I did political talk radio for a while, and I don't deal in that world at all anymore. I've decided that, you know, existential problems are really the most important thing. That, you know, the struggles that people deal with in their lives and in their minds, more importantly, are really the most important thing and the thing that needs to be addressed. And I get more emails from people literally saying, you know, I've gotten emails from people saying I was going to kill myself. And now I don't feel alone anymore. Hmm. You know, I thought I was the only one that had these feelings. You know, your neurotic rage or your neurotic rants, you know, relax me. I'm having some sort of what's the drug they give to hyperactive people?
Ritalin.
Yeah, I'm having a Ritalin effect on introspective neurotic people. And I couldn't have hoped for that. And it's very gratifying. It's very moving to me. You know, I try to respond to the emails. You know, I'm not a professional of any kind. You know, I just do what I do. But I'm very grateful that it's having that effect. And I feel like I'm helping a little bit. So success on that level is great. And I feel like I have a freedom of mind, and I'm finally sort of, you know, living in my own body and grateful to be doing what I'm doing. So
you've been broke in the past. Is this making you money?
A few times. Well, it's starting to. You know, it's an interesting world out there. It's sort of the Wild West of the podcast, because, you know, you want as many people as possible to be able to get them for free, because it is sort of that there is that that element of what we're doing, this sort of a punk rock element that, you know, it's just we can freely express what we want to express. And, you know, the people should be able to get it whenever they want. But, you know, there's different ways we're learning how to build a business around that. And it's starting to show some promise. You just have to figure it out. And I've never been a business guy. And you know, we're just sort of figuring it out because, you know, it's my job. You know, it takes up a lot of time, and I love doing it.
So when you bring people on, and you may not always know a whole lot about them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if I was your guest? What would you ask me?
I'd say, what's going on with you? You know, I listen to your show, and I like NPR, but a lot of times I feel like you guys are chomping at the bit to really express yourselves. I mean, where you did
just
you come from?
You just want me to jump out of the mic and rage, right?
No, I don't want you to rage. Right. You know, I'd probably, you know, ask you. I'd know a little bit about you, but I'd just sort of ask you, you know, why, you know, how you came to radio and what you wanted to do originally, and are you doing what you want to do, and you know that kind of stuff.
Yeah, those are good questions.
Yeah,
I actually am a little bit reluctant at times to reveal too much because someone's actually trying to kill me. True story.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes, you know, that's the gamble you take. They might not want to kill you anymore if you really tell them who you are.
Yeah.
I've always had this belief that if you have a stalker, the best thing you can do is have lunch with them and disappoint them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I that's not a bad idea.
Because they've built some idea of you
based
on what you are showing them. But sometimes if you just show them that you're just this person that has foibles and weaknesses and you know, and you show them the other part of your personality, you know, hopefully they'll go like, you're nothing like the guy I invented.
So where do you go now? I mean, you got this podcast. It's getting a huge number of people listening to it, and you're getting all this attention for it. What do you think? I mean, what is this? Do you keep doing it for a while?
Yeah, I like doing it, and I'd like to sort of figure out, you know, where I can go with the medium. I mean, we both are in, you know, audio, and I like doing a lot of different types of shows. You know, like I like doing shows in my car. I want to talk to a broader swath of people. You know, I want to start talking to people that, you know, I can learn other things from. You know, I'm curious about a lot of things, you know, art, philosophy, movies. I'd like to start, you know, branching out a little bit in terms of who I talk to and how the show, you know, feels. I want to do some more stuff on the road. You know, on one episode, I interviewed a guy I was in a band with in seventh grade who I hadn't seen in 30 years, and he's an astronomer now and built things for the Hubble telescope and those kind of things I like. I just want to, you know, kind of, you know, push myself out there a little more and think of some more creative ways to use the medium.
What about stand-up? You're still doing a lot of stand-up, right?
I'm doing more stand-up than I've ever done in my life, you know, because of the podcast, you know, people have an awareness of me. It's very interesting because a lot of my podcast fans have never seen me do stand-up, so they come to the shows going, I don't know how if he's good at this, you know? So it's sort of interesting, but I am doing a lot of stand-up work. And I'm also going to be writing a book. I just did a deal to write a book, so I have to write now. I have to make some space in my garage to write.
That's Mark Maron. You can hear his podcast at iTunes or at WTFpod.com. Mark Maron, thanks.
Thank you.